We intersected and we served together for some years in Hong Kong. And so we have kind of a common understanding of some life and ministry and some commitments there. I'm just pleased that they are here just long enough to see the good points of... that was not fair. And we do like people who tour China. We do try to control the things that they see and the people. No, that's also not nice. That's not fair. Actually, Pastor Temi and I go back for a few years as I know him as my pastor, and as all of you do know and will increasingly understand and appreciate, there's a special bond with one who pastors or shepherds you. And I feel that with Pastor Temi. He's also a colleague. He is a mission partner because we did some things that overlapped over in Hong Kong and on into China, in fact. And even a tennis partner. And watch out for the man. His understanding of love and service, they are something that they are inflicted on a person. They are not something shared. He's really had a very rich and full life, and I'm just very quickly going to share some of that with you, not for the sake of the details, but so you understand the sweep of the kinds of things that the Lord has involved him in over the years. He was born into a parsonage. So he knew ministry from before he knew anything else, I suppose. Graduated from Concordia Seminary in 1955. Actually, it was Concordia Seminary in Adelaide, Australia. But it was Concordia Seminary nonetheless. And had ministries in Australia ranging from his initial ministry among the Aboriginal peoples there, whom he has described in class here these days as among the most primitive people on earth. And if you've seen some of his slides, you have a little bit of a feel for that. Was also involved in a more normal parish-type ministry, was involved in the military chaplaincy in Australia, and from Australia was called to serve the Aborigines in Centralia, Illinois. Which was quite a reach. And he served there 12 years. That's just down the road. Southern Illinois, rural-type parish, very, very American, whatever that means. Very, very traditional place. From there, he moved to a much larger urban parish in Baltimore, Maryland, Emmanuel, where he served for 8 years. Then moved into more administrative-type things. He served as director of development, vice president, actually, for development for Wheat Ridge Ministries, fundraising. And from there was called to serve the pastorate of Church of All Nations in Hong Kong, which is a member congregation of the LCMS, one of the very, very, very few that is outside the geographical limits of the United States. Very different ministry. You can hardly have gone much further from the most primitive people on earth to a ministry among some of the most affluent and some of the most power-driving people. That formed the congregation in Hong Kong, served there in conjunction with the school that our LCMS operates there, Hong Kong International School, powerhouse school of some 2,500 students, incredibly rich school. And from there, he even reached out to help form a congregation in Beijing in what we at least used to call communist China. So the ministry has moved in a lot of different continents and a lot of different parts of the world and has taken on a lot of different forms. He has much to share with us just as we have been sharing with him. And I am very, very pleased to share him now with you.
Thank you, Hank. One of the things you forgot was I was also a vacancy pastor when I came back here. I was back here, I retired 2.5 years ago, and I was back about 1 week, and my district president, Tom Zender, said, "Hey, Temi, I've got a vacancy for you. Would you go to Nassau in the Bahamas 1 week a month?" Well, I always told vicars that ministry was hell, and I thought I'll just have to do it. So for 18 months, I stalled the calling of a pastor in that... Uh, It's been an absolute delight for us to be here. You have been so friendly and so warm and so made us feel so welcome. People have stopped us and spoken to me and to June and said, we're happy to have you here. And it's just been great for us. I've had to explain a couple of times that when I'm regarded as a missionary, people think I have worked with people, the Chinese people in Asia. And even when they say, you are connected with the school, yes, except there is a difference. The Lutheran Church has some wonderful local Chinese schools and small little shopfront Lutheran churches in Hong Kong. And you hear something of the rooftop schools and things like that. That's not where we worked. We worked with English-speaking people. But I did use as a theme today a quote from Mao Zedong, who said, we think too small. Like the frog at the bottom of the well, he thinks the sky is only as big as the top of the well. If he surfaced, he would have an entirely different view. And Mao Zedong was right. And I think that's happened in my life a lot too. When I was ready to graduate in 1955 and accept a call in a wonderful congregation, I was given call papers that sent me out into the Australian desert, where the temperature was 115 degrees, where they had 3 inches of rain a year. One year we got it all on one day, where we had no electricity. We were 650 miles away from Adelaide. We were 100 miles from the doctor. We were 30 miles from our nearest neighbor. And it was an incredible experience. That in itself convinced me that Mao Zedong was right. It was very easy to come out of the seminary with just the vision from the bottom of the well. And when I got out, I found out the firmament was so much larger than that restricted vision. So I'm going to tell you a couple of things and then give you a chance to ask me some questions. I'll try to give you answers. If not, I'll make up something. Some of the things that I think have helped to broaden my vision. And that the first one is a respect for people who are different from you. I don't know about you, but I feel very comfortable with people who are about like me, who look like me, not quite as short. I never know if they're shorter preachers or they want short preachers, but either way, I seem to fit in. You mentioned something about golf. I was with a district president once, and he's playing too much golf. He was using the overlapping grip on the chalice. Yeah. You got to watch these guys, I tell you. But you see, an Aborigine, a very primitive kind of dumb person, you might think. Let me give you a couple of examples. One is, if I, a white man, went out into the desert, I'd die within a fortnight. Do you know how long a fortnight is, David? Okay, don't worry. It's 2 weeks. But an Aborigine knows that at the bottom of certain trees, if he scrapes the dirt away and pulls out a root and breaks it, there is about an egg cup full of water. And if he does that 5 or 6 times, he gets a cup full of water. He's clever enough to track an animal. He will say, that kangaroo went there this morning. Well, I said, how do you know? How do you know he never went there at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon? Oh, he says, you can see that the prints are fresh. That one went yesterday afternoon, 4 o'clock, because you can see where some insects have walked across the track. Very, very clever in his own right. Or their houses. One of the things, if you look at the history of missions, you'll notice that one of the first things that we've done in years is when you Christianize primitive people, the first thing you do is put clothes on them. Why do you think the Women's Missionary League sends clothes to all sorts of places all around the world? It's very important to clothe people. And the Aborigines went along with that. When they were in the mission compound, they put their pants on. When they got 100 yards away from the mission compound, they hung them on a tree and went around doing things their normal kind of a way. And they didn't even know how to wear them. But, you know, we try to tell them that that's what they should do. So we put clothes on them. Then, you know what we do when we make a fire? Let's say the Aborigine gets wet. And then what we would do is build a great, white people build a great big bonfire. Then they stand back like this. Oh, God, it's hot. Oh, can't get too close to it. But an Aborigine builds a tiny little fire and sits on top of it and takes his clothes off, he knows not to wear damp clothes. He has two kinds of medicine, simple stuff. One's used internally, the other used externally. He calls one rubbing medicine, the other drinking medicine. It's so simple, so simple. So I think one thing I've learned is, learn to respect other people who are different from you, and you can really learn a lot about it, about them. Okay? Let's go to Hong Kong. You need to recognize that Hong Kong was a ministry with affluent people. That probably gave me the biggest shock. You know, you can find all sorts of materials to help you minister to homeless and poor people. While I was in Hong Kong, I asked the church here in the Holy City, I asked the Higgins Road in Chicago, have you any material to minister that will help me minister to affluent people? No, no. The other day I had a chance to sit in on some of the big shots here in the faculty, the dignitaries who were in a mission think tank, and they were talking about how easy it is for poor people to have a need for some, but the rich people seems to be different. And I hope they that comes some time for action to be taken by that committee and they can prepare some. When I talk about affluence, Hank mentioned this, Dr. Rowald mentioned the school. The school had a tuition of $15,000 American dollars. That didn't include board. I mean, that wasn't a boarding school. That was just regular tuition for the year. One of the members who was the head of Asia Pacific Amoco paid $225,000 American dollars a year rent for his house. One of the dangers of being an affluent person in that area, I'll give you an example. This man was the head of the largest container brokerage firm in the world, and they would argue for 6 weeks at their annual meetings on 1 cent per ton for shipping across the Pacific. His son was sick in hospital. I went to see his son. His son had the biggest array of video and audio electronic equipment that I have ever seen. It looked like a radio station, but it was what his father had rented for him in the hospital room. Where was his father? On business. He flew 68% of his time. He was going from Tokyo to New York. That's not what that son needed. And it becomes very difficult to minister to people like that. But I think it widened my vision because I realized that there are some very rich people. If you've got one rich person in your council, I don't want to get stuck into your church councils the way you, if I keep knocking the church councils, you guys, seminarians, won't even go to your church council meetings, which is not a bad idea either. But if you have a man that wants to say, look, I'll give you $10,000 to meet your budget for the end of the year, you know that the rest of the church council members will say, well, why shouldn't he? He's got it. Get your antenna up and listen. You'll hear that kind of a thing. But there are some wonderful people whom God has richly blessed. And I know that this seminary is starting to tap some of those people. And those people would like to give and would like to do it quietly and do it as a grace of God and a ministry of Christian giving. So that widened my vision to realize there's some people like that too. I sort of widened my Oshkosh. No, that I promised one of the classes I wouldn't say Oshkosh again. I didn't want to broaden my Centralia. I needed to broaden my Centralia vision and realize that there was a Lutheran seminary in Hong Kong. It wasn't a Missouri Synod seminary. You know what? They had about 150 theological students, quite a number of whom were women, and this was within 15 miles of communist China, and these people were studying theology, and some of them were from the mainland. They didn't necessarily graduate as Lutheran pastors, but they did the courses, and here they are so close to communist China that just, Hank and I were big supporters of that theological seminary. There were some wonderful Lutheran instructors there, and here were these students, hey, right up, bang up against communist China, studying Lutheran theology, biblical theology. That was a great expanding of the vision. One of the problems that helped me to expand my vision was the culture shock to learn that when you go overseas, you will find different kinds of people and different kinds of sitz im Leben. Is that a Greek expression? What is that? Sitz im Leben. I just heard my father use it once, and when he didn't want me to. Did your dad speak German when he didn't want you to know what was going on? P.K., Nagel's father, did that. So let me show you this overhead of what a congregation normally looks like. That congregation is what a lot of congregations are like. I've been in them. It's comfortable. Nothing happens. It's like in the womb, a womb congregation. It's warm, it's cozy, and nobody rocks the boat. It's just great. Can you anybody identify with one of those? Have you ever heard of one of those? Okay. The three guys from the field that are field workers are going, I know. And then the pastor and two church council members go to an evangelism seminar. And then they let some marriages take place with somebody on the outside. And so they've opened it. And they're absolutely ecstatic that their congregation is now an open congregation. And many people leave it like that, the status quo. Status quo produces mediocrity, trust me. The goal really is to open up the congregation like that. People coming in, people going out. Sharing the gospel. Don't worry about counting the statistics for evangelism. That doesn't matter. But sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ. After I had worked as a fundraiser for Wheatridge and I went back into parish ministry, I asked my buddies, what should I say? What has happened? What new programs have come down from the Holy City that I'm supposed to promote? And so they said, Temi, preach Jesus Christ to people. That's what they are looking for. They're looking to find out what Jesus Christ can do for them, what his model was, how he can give us new life in him. And so a congregation like that, that is really sort of got all sorts of people in, is exciting. And it may be the kind of one with which you can identify. Except the Church of All Nations is even different from that. That's what the Church of All Nations is like. It's also rolling. We lost 38% of our membership every year. Twice in August, as people had been transferred back to the States or some other part of the world, I started off the service. I said, is there anybody here that can play the piano this morning? We would lose our office bearers. We'd have to start off with a new council again. It was just an incredible thing. And Dan Schlenska's nodding his head. We were part of that kind of thing. Now, that is an incredible blessing. It's very difficult to keep ahead of your troops. Everybody in the congregation was a type A personality. All of us. And to keep ahead of your troops were very difficult. But it was an exciting kind of a thing. And it's rolling around like that. Maybe it isn't fair that you lose the members that you've just trained. But it opens up something new. And in no time, these kind of people would offer to help. And one of the things that I learned, that it's okay to be like that and to keep rolling. It meant I had to broaden my vision. But it did something for me, and I promised somebody I would mention this. It gave me a new appreciation for the church here. If you don't tell anybody, the president of my congregation was a Methodist, but while he was there, he placed himself under the spiritual care of that congregation. We were not fighting for denominationalism. We were fighting because 1% of the population of Hong Kong is Christian. We were fighting for Christianity versus heathenism. And this man, while he was there, became very active in the congregation. When he came back, he went back to a Presbyterian church in San Francisco of 6,000 people. His wife is now the head of the board of deacons. And he shared with me several times, as did some others, the head of Intel and so on, AT&T, that came back here. They said, you know what? When we got back to the congregation, we asked our Presbyterian pastor, how come you don't have Christ the King Sunday? How come you don't celebrate Transfiguration? How come you don't have a couple of weeks of excitement and the light and the epiphany season. Oh. And he said, why don't you have some kind of paraments that are worship aids? I'll buy the whole lot of them, he said, if you would just have them. And I learned how valuable the church year was. And it took about 20 years to get through my thick German skull how valuable and how alive the church year can be and what a teaching tool it can be. We had a Baptist, the head chaplain of the American fleet based there was a Baptist. That man came to me one day, he said, you know what? I'm starting to learn about the action of God in the sacraments, and I understand now what you mean about a sacramental action and God working through the sacraments. And that man now is out in the Atlantic somewhere teaching people the action of God, the distinctive Lutheran teaching in the sacraments. So I had a greater appreciation for the church here, and I think that broadened my vision too. Culture, okay? Culture shock. You can have a culture shock just going from Seattle to Tampa. Trust me. Where we have 75, in our congregation down there, we have 75 families who are snowbirds, who drive back here, and then they come on down there in their Cadillacs, and they come from Wisconsin and Michigan and so on, and then they're driving their Cadillac around the street, and they can't see out of it, and they're driving like this. And they're pressing buttons, and they don't know if it's the turning indicator or the radio. And they're in their turning indicator is going, it's flicking, and they're 10 miles from home, and they put it on when they came out of the garage. And there's a tremendous culture shock if you go from one part of the country to the other. You know what I'm talking about. This is exaggerated when you go overseas. And the culture shock is a disorientation caused by encounter with differing ways of thinking, behaving, and communicating that occur when you move to another cultural environment. We find we have to tell people to calm down a little bit on their expectations. Go with what they can handle. It's a lot easier to put on slippers, you know, than to carpet the whole world. Asian thinking is different from American thinking. Americans, you know, want to get everything done. Zip, 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 boom, like this. That's how they get people into their congregations. Hey, Pastor, I'd like to join your congregation. That's the pastor of St. Mary of the Wailing Wall in Lutheran Church in Oshkosh. Yes, good. Come to 5 lessons and I'll have you in. And so we get them in, and then we try to Christianize them. If you were in Korea, you would find out that the congregation Christianizes them, to use that term, and then, maybe a year later, they become members of the congregation. And they'll get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to 2 hours Bible study. That might go on for a whole year. And then they might have to make sure that they take very seriously the final words of Jesus and the Great Commission, and that they have to bring somebody to Christ first before they're accepted as a member of that congregation. That's a culture shock that you get there. So Americans find they have to sort of slow down a little bit on some of these things. Asians so often work in relationships, and it takes a long time to establish that trust and that confidence. And so sometimes it's difficult to accept. For example, some of the women had great difficulty in accepting the fact that their husbands, who were mid-management here in America, are now big shots, worth $750,000 salary, a Mercedes, a secretary, all these kind of things, and travel first class 60% of their time. Occasionally it happened that the lady was the one who was appointed by Caterpillar to go to Asia. And the husband had a greater difficulty in accepting the culture shock than anybody else. So for a while, there's entry, there's a while after they come, there's fascination and excitement in the honeymoon, then there's subtle irritation, and after about 6 and 8 months, then there could be complete frustration and depression and all those kinds of things. You have to tell them there's a big difference between acupuncture and American medicine. There's a big difference between ginseng and aspirin, and it takes a while to get used to that. One of the things that broadened my vision was how valuable, I don't know if I can use the word koinonia, the valuable the fellowship of the congregation was. And if you were to take one bullet or two bullets home from this discussion, which will become a discussion in a minute, the congregation can be a very valuable, warm, loving, supportive experience, not just for the members, but for the pastor too. I realized also in Hong Kong that Christians more often are, well, have you watched a movie lately? Have you ever seen an airport scene when the plane comes in? Do you ever see United Airlines written on the plane? No, you don't. You see something like Florida Flyer or something that they've made up. Occasionally you might see United Airlines, for which they have paid a huge amount of money to have that sign in that movie. It's called product placement. And we as Christians, especially in a place like Asia, a product placement. Sometimes we wonder, what are those English-speaking teachers doing in China? They are a product placement at a great price. I learned something how valuable product placement was. And if it's valuable there, it's probably valuable here too. Okay, I'm going to stop there and see if you've got some questions that you might like to ask me.
Pastor Timmy?
Yes.
This working? Welcome, I'm Steve Oliver. I called you when I was making a chaplain visit in Hong Kong, about, I guess it was about 5 years ago during Christmas time.
Okay.
Do you remember that phone call?
Yeah, sure do.
Okay. Good. I could see it in your eyes. my question is, Hong Kong, in the coming decades, do you think Hong Kong will have a bigger effect politically on the mainland? And also, secondly, what do you think will happen with Taiwan and the mainland?
Okay. One of the things we learned in Hong Kong was, after we had many meetings discussing these very things, that when we finished, only the expert who came from America for those three-day meetings knew the answer. The people that lived there and we who worked there had no idea what was going to happen. We were worried in the church and we were worried in that school that things would really go downhill when the PRC people took over, the People's Republic of China took over Hong Kong. What we found was the school went from 2,300 kids up to 2,500. And another thing, I have this theory that the Chinese government will not adversely affect that school or the Church of All Nations for this reason, these reasons. Oddly as it is, the Lord has got a great sense of humor. He's just incredible that, or she is just incredible that communism loves some of the things that Christianity stands for. Respect for authority. They can't stand American democracy where there's such disrespect. They love respect for parents. They like respect for tribal history. They like development of character in the kids, and they love a good quality education. And Chinese parents will sacrifice all sorts of things for an education for their kids. They happen to be the things that the Church of All Nations and Hong Kong Lutheran School stand for. So I think that it will not be adversely affected. I think also that despite what you read in the paper, more things happen in China with the Christian church than you realize. Hank and I decided one day we ought to try to minister to the expats in Beijing. I went in at the invitation of a Presbyterian family. We had 17 people at the first service. And when we finished, there are 125 people worshiping. David knows he was one of them, David Wilson, worshiping in Hong Kong, a wonderful experience of whom? In Beijing, and I guess, how many, David, were the three Lutheran families or something like that? That's about all. All of these Christians, right in the center of communism, a heathen country. But the one thing we didn't do was flaunt it. Neither do our missionaries that are English-speaking teachers. They don't flaunt it. You're in for a lot of trouble. You see, some of these things you read about in the paper are people who have a martyr complex. They used to give me materials and say, Pastor Timmy, we'll show you how you can sneak Bibles into China. And they call it the donkey parade, you know, and they'd sneak all these kind of things in. When Dr. Rowald went into China, we know what he went with. He had two suitcases, he had Bibles and all sorts of stuff, and he'd struggle through the airport like this, you know. And if they asked him, I've done it many times. To get visas, we just put down we were teachers, which we are, and went in. If they want to look at the Bibles, fine. If they want to confiscate them, somebody at the airport picked up a Bible. And there are new churches being built. We didn't bring pictures of it, but you ought to sit down with Dr. Rowald and ask him and see some of the new churches that are being built in China. There might be 40 million Christians. Sometimes people say there could be as many as 80 million Christians. And you know when that church grew? This is another wild thing to tell seminarians and faculty members. The church grew when there was no ordained clergy. Sorry about that. I'm really sorry about that. But the church grew and grew. It's just incredible. So I think things are positive. The worst thing, I think, in Hong Kong is the economical problem. But that's the same anywhere in Asia. Do you invest in the stock market?
Yes, that's Taiwan.
Taiwan. I can't give you an answer on Taiwan. You can ask Dr. Rowald on that. He's an expert on Taiwan. Any other questions?
If you remember Steve Oliver's phone call from 6 years ago or whatever, then surely you remember that 18 years ago I was Jerry Kuhn's vicar while you were still in Baltimore. My name's Bill Carr. There are several questions that actually occur to me, and I'm just going to kind of, you know, click off three possibilities and see what you do with them. One is, I think that in the context of the kind of conversation that happens here at the seminary, that talking about broadened horizons and the kind of transcultural setting that you experienced in Hong Kong, one question certainly would have to do with the matter of communion practice and how you deal with that when you've got, you know, all of your miscellaneous letters in addition to, you know, LCMS. The second would be in the context of the idea of broadened horizons. Yesterday and today, St. Louis has experienced something in terms of product placement with the presence of the Pope. And yesterday evening and today have been, aside from the commentary of various experts, and it was interesting that at least two of the local stations had ex-Lutherans, Richard John Newhouse on one and a professor out of Kenrick for another. What use, or how can we capitalize on the kind of product placement that the Bishop of Rome brings to our setting? And that's two, and that'll be enough.
On the second one, I don't really know, but for example, when I was at Wheat Ridge and I would go to a congregation that used the red hymnal, I didn't say to them, boy, that's pretty dumb, why don't you get into the Lutheran worship or something like that. That's fine. That's their cultural setting there. That's what they do. When I ministered, I didn't make a big fuss. If they had an extreme close communion, or if they had women sitting on one side, men sitting on the other, while I was there, I did what they did. My district president told me that that's what should be done also in Hong Kong, which is an exceptional place, and there are, in the church's teachings on Holy Communion, practicing open communion, there are certain special cases that they speak about. So the congregation resolved that they would, after letting people know clearly what the teaching of the Corinthians was on the Lord's Supper, if people said, yes, we accept that, we would give them communion. When the first vice president and second vice president of Synod, I think they were the current ones, or a couple of years ago, came on out for a Timothy visit, or it was some kind of a visit like that, we knew that the first question they would ask us was about Holy Communion. I gave them that answer, and they said, we understand in that situation that's what you would do. And that's what the congregation practiced.
Then I want to follow up, and for at least on the order of 20 years, when Ed Westcott was the executive for the Board for Mission Services, we have talked about the fact that the world is coming to the U.S. How does that alter, or what kind of factor does that constitute in how we approach that today, recognizing that, you know, we are, St. Louis is a cross-cultural, you know, international kind of city and so forth.
How it will affect the distribution of communion, I don't really know. That's something congregations decide with their district presidents. But one of the things that we notice is happening, that there are a lot of Asians coming over here, and I would hope that some of our seminary, I'd hope that the church would have enough money to there are about 40 million Chinese business people, families scattered throughout the world who speak English, who want to live in the Caucasian world, who become a big mission field. And more of these people are coming, and you'll find it more and more in your school. David, didn't you tell me there's some Asian people at the school where your little girl goes? And I think we need to broaden our vision some way, somehow, to include those kind of people. And we may need some special kind of training for that. I want to mention one other thing, and this is something I learned that I think is important. How do you handle the business people in these foreign countries who are exposed to bribery and that kind of thing? These businessmen would sit down and say to me, one man's bribe is another man's finder's fee. That's what happens in foreign countries. So, unless you gave a bribe to this person or that person, then the contract for building that new factory would not go ahead. And they struggled, and they still struggle with that kind of a problem. Is there any ethical common ground in heathen lands? I don't know a lot about that. I just know that this is the problem that these people face. And I'm sure if you talk to Dr. Rowald or Dr. Kolb, this is the same in lots of other places too. Any other questions? We've got to finish by... Okay, comes David.
One other question. In the congregation in Beijing, there were some people who were English teachers over there who were living on a shoestring, and other people in the congregation that had lots of money. And it was, I mean, I've never seen that kind of disparity in one congregation before. Did you have that situation in Hong Kong, and what was the effect?
Absolutely. The one common thing they all had was they were all type A personalities, but the salaries were tremendous. Our own LCMS missionaries are very poorly paid overseas. That's if you're a man. If you're a woman, it would be even worse, you know, which is also illegal, I guess. But they were very poorly paid. And so you will have that disparity. The armors, you know what an armor is? Any of you read Rudyard Kipling? The female workers, the workers, the house workers from the Philippines. They would work there. They'd earn $5,000 a year, $4,000 of which they'd send back to Manila. So you had those in the congregation. Many of them were type A personalities too, because they were high school teachers back in Manila, but were now working as domestics. So there is that kind of disparity. But what is so incredible is the Spirit gets this koinonia going amongst all these people who love and serve each other. And I know, David, you gave me an example of somebody in... You know this congregation now, Hank, is self-supporting in Beijing? And you know what a couple of the guys that left recently said? You know, this congregation can be self-supporting. And if when we go back to South Africa or we go back to America, you don't have enough money, call us and we'll give you enough to make sure that that English-speaking congregation in Beijing can be self-supporting. There is an incredible working of the Spirit there.
Any other questions? How hungry are you?
Okay, I got one more thing to tell you so that you remember what I said. First week, I live in a retired community with 800 homes, all people. You have to be 55 to own there, and it's a lot of old people. So, and everybody goes for a walk, you know, that's our exercise. So one first week I was there, I was walking, and I saw a guy, and I said, "Hey, George," I said, "what's the name of that new car you've got?" "Oh," he said, "it's got electric shock absorbers." I said, "What's the name of your car?" "Oh," he said, It's got buttons that you can do this. I said, "What's the name of your car?" He said, "It doesn't have to be serviced for 100,000 miles." I said, "George, what's the name of your car?" He said, Hugh, what's that bush that comes up out of the ground? It's got green leaves on it, sometimes a white flower, sometimes a pink flower. It's got thorns on it. I said, Rose. He said, Rose, what's the name of the car that we drive? Ha ha ha.